Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Hooray.
Cheer of one! Yes!
I'm Richard Nicholas, hello. And with me to chat about films is Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
And Abigail Bain.
Hello.
So guys, this week's film that Jamie picked for us to watch was Mad Max 3 or Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. They don't think there's a there in it.
No, but everyone says it like that.
I just call it Mad Max 3 because I just think the title sounds stupid any other way. So call it whatever you want. But it's the third one in the Mad Max franchise. Kind of a bit cult for us. I mean, 1 and 2 are probably too mainstream. And 3 is probably too poor for us to usually do. We try and hit mediocrity. Not too bad. That's done. Loads of podcasts do bad films. Loads of podcasts do good films. We try and get the middle. But this time, you picked 3, Jamie.
I have the streak that I have to maintain of picking films that everybody hates.
My mind instantly goes to Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah. And it's always what I quite like as well.
Rock and Rule, that's another gem.
Oh, maybe not that one.
But Jamie, why did you want us to watch Mad Max 3 then?
Well, I wanted... I was looking for sequels that could be considered misguided.
Yeah.
And the third Mad Max film is like... The first two are very much like low-budget exploitation, or they're known as Ozploitation, like cult movies. They're pretty violent. They're like very underground. They're very cheap and dirty. And then the third one's got this weird kind of angling for PG thing going on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's odd. It's sort of amps up the budget and tries to be bolder and even more, try and tap in more to the aesthetic it created in 2, and tries to be a little bit kiddie as well, which is odd, because children probably didn't watch them unless they weren't supposed to. Like, kids, if they watched Mad Max 1 and 2, were the kids who, like, got hold of their dad's VHS collection or something.
I remember watching the Mad Max movies with my dad when I was a kid. I don't think I saw the first one until I was an adult, but I saw The Road Warrior and Beyond Thunderdome a few times when I was a kid.
Yeah, so it's kind of... It's not really like they were planned for children to watch the first ones, though, is it?
No, they were definitely just done as, like...
Motorhead, kind of... People who like cars and crashes and a bit of anti-hero silliness.
That's the other sort of misguided thing in this one, maybe, is the car angle is very downplayed in the third one.
It's almost like they stick it in at the end just to go, and the wacky racer bit, where everyone turns up and looks weird and drives along trying to hit each other like it's Road Rash.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're jumping ahead a bit. We haven't even explained, you know, like who made the film and who's in it. Because that's kind of, we need a few credits, don't we?
Well, I have it all ready to go.
Well, please tell the listener in case they've never heard of the film.
Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome is the third film in the Mad Max trilogy, which will at some point be added to because they're currently making, I think, 2 more. It's directed by George Miller, who directed the first 2 and also directed Babe, Pig in the City.
Of course he did. Classic, obvious next movie.
Written by Terry Hayes and George Miller, starring Mel Gibson, Tina Turner, Bruce Spence, and I don't think anyone else memorable. But, the summary on IMDb is great because a former Australian policeman is rescued by a tribe of children where he's banished from a desert town and sent out into the desert to die by the desert town's evil queen. Desert
That's
town.
That's much sense it doesn't make.
I think it does. It makes it sound a lot more acceptable than what was on.
Basically, Mel Gibson is wandering around in the desert. He goes into a big cage, bounces around a bit, and then they kick him out and some kids find him and take him back and they steal a big train.
Although it's sort of a car as well.
I don't know.
A bit weird. It also powers, in some way, a pig fart factory. there's a lot more weirdness to it. But I'll ask... So, Jamie, you watched these with your dad as a kid, so that was your first exposure to the Mad Max lot.
Yeah, I've always, like, I think Mad Max, particularly the second one, and probably this one, was my first exposure to, like, post-apocalypse. The idea of, like...
Dystopian futures. Yeah.
And I just always, I really enjoyed them. They are very, like, people would probably argue with me, but there's very little subtext in the Mad Max films. They are just, like, particularly the first two, for the most part, it's just adrenaline.
Yeah, occasionally it tries to say something about society's aspirations and dreams. I think it does occasionally sort of hint that people have want to get free of their problems and tyranny, but they might be holding up a false sort of idea of what the future might hold or the next town or whatever.
It's not lacking in story or humanity, but it's very sort of action, like they're very brisk, straightforward action movies.
A lot of tension in one, though. A lot of it isn't so much the action as it is the build-up to potential violence or something.
Yeah, it's this, because it's a survivalist thing.
Yeah.
It's more about, because as soon as you're in the situation where all you have to do is try and stay alive, then there isn't going to be subtext, because it's all about the now and what's happening currently.
Yeah. And it's an interesting genre, the post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah, and they all do different, like, the three Mad Max films do different things with it. Like, the first one is, you know, society's kind of collapsing. It hasn't quite gone over the brink, but stuff is falling apart and things are getting very vicious and violent. And it reminds me a little bit, it's like an Australian version of The Wild One.
Yeah.
Like, people driving around on bikes and, like, terrorizing little towns and stuff. And And then the second one is, it's like pure survival once society has completely collapsed. And presumably there's some kind of mass extinction or war. And then the third one is this kind of, it was the first one of the trilogy to get American funding. So it is like almost the Hollywood version of the second one. It also reminds me a lot of Hook. But
obvious comparisons.
There. I didn't say as well. It was made in 1985.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So
because 1979 was the first one, and that is low budget. It's weirdly dubbed. If you get the ones where all American voices are doing the Australians, who must have been too incomprehensible for an American ear.
that's a question. Actually, did you watch when you watched the three of them? Did you watch them with the Australian track or the American track?
I
don't know if we had an option. We watched the American one, but I don't know if we had the choice to watch it with the Australian one.
Okay, because I really like all three of them, so I got them on Blu-ray, and I think on DVD, the default is American, but you can go in and pick Australian, whereas on Blu-ray, the default, I think it just has Australian.
So is the Australian one better or worse, would you say?
I don't think I've ever seen the American dub.
It just seems like, like any dubbed film where it's like off because people aren't sounding like the people.
Yeah.
Like, but in this case, they are speaking the language of the people in the film.
Yeah.
So it's a bit bizarre.
It is still jarring even now to see Mel Gibson speak with an Australian accent.
I guess. I mean, it's not like wrong because he's Australian, but.
But you're so used to him being like American action movie star.
I guess so. But it's interesting as well because isn't it his first film, the first one?
I think so, yeah.
Anyway, we've all seen these films before. Abby, when did you see the Mad Max films originally?
Oh, quite a long time ago. So my memory of them was patchy at best, really.
So we looked at them all, but we're focusing on three because that's the one JB wants to, like, torture us with, I don't know. But I watched them, like, you know, when I was a teenager, and I remember thinking, wow, three was bit naff as a sequel, and now I've rewatched them all, and I can confirm, pretty much. I'd go so far as to maybe suggest it does as much damage to the franchise as Highlander 2 did.
Oh.
But you don't agree, Jamie? You don't think it's that bad?
No, because Highlander 2 is utterly incomprehensible.
You can't see where they came from. Whereas
like
Mad Max 3, you get, you wanted to do something, and then you went a bit Hook at the end.
Yeah, it's misguided, but it's not nonsensical. Like, it doesn't completely contradict the previous films like Highlander 2 does.
Yeah.
In, you know, an admirably ridiculous way.
Hmm. Well, I don't know. I'll anger Abby if we linger any longer on Highlander 2. She's a massive Highlander fan, and everything after that maybe outside of the TV show, is considered a betrayal. With 3 exclamation marks. But just to sort of not... To put aside Mad Max 1 and 2, I would just say that the first one is very low budget, the story of a cop trying to outrun and get away from a rather horrid gang of like motorcycle thugs. And they have a slightly alternative, sort of weird aesthetic to them. They're not shoulder pads and like Road Warrior style. Like, they're not Legion of Doom, Mad Max style. Like, there's a kind of image you associate with Mad Max, and it wasn't really fully there and developed in one, was it?
It was mostly police uniforms and...
I'm going to shave off one eyebrow and dye a bit of my hair and be horrible. And vaguely alternative. They all looked really cool, the biker gang in that. They were all very different looking to each other. But they were just a biker gang who were a bit horrible. And then in 2, we kind of move things on. It's after an apocalypse, shanty towns, and people are like a bit more primitive. There's no power and there's no, you know, traditional civilization. And it's all about trying to... It's all about making fuel and keeping fuel. And again, the gangs have escalated into quite large, scary S&M. Weird, like sports equipment meets S&M meets...
Yeah, that was the other thing punk. That they put, you know, aside in the third one is the strange, like, homosexual undertones of the first two.
I don't know if they did put them aside. I think they picked them back up again, Jamie. I think they did. You think there's a sort of vaguely S&M... gay scene bondage thing about the mad. There's a kind of, what is it trying to say about masculinity in them, do you think, James?
It's, well, I mean...
Assless chaps, is that what you're thinking?
The first one has even... it's been a while since I watched it, but the first one even has a suggested scene where a male victim is raped by the biker gang, where they find a couple who've been attacked, and she's been beaten up, but she's still clothed, and he's running away into the fields... And he's, like, naked from the bottom down and is bloody.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a suggestion there that they did something to him that they didn't do to her. And then you've got, in the second one, you've got, I can't remember the characters' names, but
they're a sort of car, motorhead gang. I don't know, not a motorhead, that makes it sound like the band, but they're a kind of... vehicle gang, and one of them does have like a sort of biking buddy who sits with him.
And he's, if I remember right, he's got him on a lead, like a dog collar.
Oh, no. In the second one, that the guy you're on about, who has a boyfriend who was killed by a sharpened boomerang by a child, because it's Australian, you know, why not? But that guy has a boyfriend, and he's on like a collar with a guy who wears a hockey mask, but also kind of executioner style straps. Like, it's really weird. There's a lot of weirdness.
You know, his name is Lord Humongous, and he's a giant muscular guy in leather.
Yeah,
very little leather gear. It's just very, and there's little hints of it in Beyond Thunderdome, but it seems, again, it seems to me this going for the PG thing. Like, some of the outfits are there. There's a scene later in the film where two guys are arm wrestling in the pig fart factory.
A lot of what's the thing Tarzan wears?
Loincloth.
Loincloths, both in the society-ish bit where there's like in Bartertown, men just wear less clothes because it's hot, and I don't know why else. And but the kids, there's kids wearing loincloths because they're sort of primitive as well.
Yeah,
a lot more loincloths going on in 3.
I think the thing with the third one is nobody gets enough development for them to be straight or gay.
Yeah,
but the main thing with 2 is it's quite a simple plot. There's a group of town. There's a town people who've made a refinery, and because fuel is short, because society's collapsed, they want to use that fuel they've made to sort of pay their way back into a sort of civilized city or something nearby, a town. They have some aspiration that they can use the fuel to get a better life. And there's a horrible gang of like people in sort of, I don't know, Vigilante 8, maybe a better reference would be Wacky Racers. I don't know. Like what the sort of, what, just vehicle gang with lots of different styles. And they're kind of sport chop meets punk meets S&M bondage. like, it's just that weird Mad Max style that was influential to the Legion of Doom, the wrestlers, well, and some other people, I guess.
Thing as well about the Mad Max films is that, as is the case with a lot of, like, low-budget cult movies, especially from, like, the 70s and the 80s, even though... Well, no, I, like, by now, they're pretty famous. Like, people know who Mad Max, you know, the character is. But when they came out, they weren't huge, but they became very influential. Like, you see references to that particular apocalyptic world everywhere. Like, video games like Fallout 3, which have, like, outright... As well. Yeah.
There's a lot, like, the video game genre loves post-apocalyptic stories because it's so fun. And Mad Max kind of... Mad Max almost was one of the main creators of that, the image of the get old stuff because we can't make it any better and nail more rusty stuff and spikes on.
Yeah.
And just everything becomes utility. So suddenly you just put extra padding on everything and you wear extra stuff and you don't care. You just bolt it all together and solder it and that'll do. And that's the kind of visual style that Mad Max pioneered, really, isn't it? And is known for. And that comes through in the second one, which is just about trying to get a truck through the baddies, and the baddies trying to take the kind of villagers down. Not villagers, but the people who made the fuel. It's just the story of trying to stop a truck, basically.
And there's a great, like, the second one ends with a really spectacular chase, and then the third one ends also with a chase that is not quite so spectacular.
Yeah.
I mean, by that point, I'd become quite confused, because... There'd been some heel and face turns that didn't really commit in either way. Like, the look at the master. I thought he was a bad guy until he just had to live some pigs for a bit, and then suddenly he was a good guy that they were rescuing. Well, and then he dressed as a Victorian, which made him fine. It's just, I didn't know who was good and who was bad anymore, so I ceased to care who was dying.
Once Max... and the kids leave there, they decide to carry on to Bartertown, it stops making sense.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's no motivation. It's just, oh yeah, they're going to break into Bartertown and nick the big train thing. And I was thinking, well, why? Like Max said, there's no... I'm jumping ahead, but he says there's no... He believes, that he knows that everything's gone. There's no cities left.
Mm.
But then, and he refuses to help them. And then he goes, okay, I'll help you.
But he helps them. We're at the end. It's hard to start at the end. But you're right. There's a lot of inconsistency at the end, and I think it's partially because we've got sort of two villain characters who are quite iconic: Tina Turner, who runs Bartertown, which is the main staple of the location and kind of what the plot is driven around. She is sort of the queen and leader of this criminal bartering township, and there's also a kind of midget who rides a giant man in a weird helmet. He can make methane gas from pigs. Just pig's mess, you know? And that's needed to create fuel to run the town. And they're both villainous, but they also both flip and are a bit nice at times and aren't as brutal and horrible as the previous gangs are.
It tries to win your sympathy when it reveals what Blaster really is. He's a giant with the mind of a child, and then... Auntie's goons kill him, and you're like, oh, Master's a good guy now, then, clearly.
And let's put Victorian clothes on him, as you mentioned, Abby. He can wear a bowler hat and be all nice now. What? Even though he's the most horrible, nasty villain in a pig factory. Like, anyway, let's go back to the start, and we'll get back to these characters, who we haven't explained any context for, really. But our inn is... from the second movie, which this kind of references in ways that are confusing, because it has characters reappear in it who aren't actors who are playing characters from the previous Mad Max 2, but aren't playing themselves, but are clearly referencing characters too. Because Max leaves the town, like, he's basically left on his own. He's back left in, like, I can't think what the term is for where
it's the outback.
So yeah, Max is just left in the outback.
He's in the wasteland, basically.
Yeah. And walking the earth because he's kind of lost everything in one. And now in three, he's driving some camels and a sort of makeshift kind of car thing.
But it's the remains of his car, isn't it?
I thought that got ruined, like, in two.
Oh, it's the remains of a car.
He's got a kind of car caravan with camels. And then two characters in a plane who are from the previous movie, but not the same characters. Is that right?
The kid isn't, I don't think. It's only the pilot, the gyro, who is in this film called Jedediah. And I think in Mad Max 2, he's just called the...
Mr. Bird or something. What's his
gyrocopter
name?
Pilot, yeah, or something. Yeah.
He hasn't got like a proper name.
But yeah, they're played by they're both played by Bruce Spence, and they are like, it is essentially the same character.
Launchpad McQuack.
Yeah, it is the same character, but it's also clearly not, because they have no memory of each other. They like, and also I think his teeth have been fixed.
Right, that'll do.
Yeah, it's clearly not the same guy.
Playing the same character. But at the end of 2, it's basically... And that guy goes on to lead the tribe of people who survived. And it's like, oh, does he? Because he seemed like a bit of a derpy sidekick in the second one. But okay, he does. And the kid grew up and told the story and the legend of Mad Max in 2. And never saw them again. And then clearly a reference to the kid and the guy, but they're not them. We just wanted them in image-wise. And they basically fly in, scare... No, they just... somehow knock Max off his vehicle and then they rob him and then he has to turn up in Bartertown with nothing because he's been robbed by two heroes from the previous movie in slightly different costumes.
One of the things that I think George Miller said at some point, I can't find it now, was that he wanted the Mad Max films to be like the Man With No Name trilogy, which is directly referenced in this. When Max is introduced into the Thunderdome, he's called the Man With No Name.
Even though they know his name.
Yeah. But I think what he wanted was it to not... He wanted the audience to question whether or not it was the same guy, like they're supposed to with Clint Eastwood in the Spaghetti Western, like the Man With No Name trilogy. So that's why you have, like, in A Few Dollars More and The Good, The Bad and The Ugly... you have actors who've appeared in previous films appearing again, but playing different characters, but still leads.
Yeah, I think it is clear that there's a kind of... It's not that the stories are legitimately however they appear. There's a legend of Max, because there's this one guy known as the Road Warrior or Mad Max, and he has saved people and contributed to helping them and fought off many different variations on motorized gangs.
Yeah.
And he's a legend of their time, and people tell stories about him, and this sort of is three different tellings of a story about Mad Max. They're kind of, you could kind of like see it as the Tales of Hercules. They all vary, and he has different names, but the gist is, it's this kind of figure, and he usually does this kind of thing.
But the thing with Bruce Spence in particular, though, was that he was playing a different character in the sense that he had a different name.
But he played the same type of character. He was.
Yeah, that's the thing.
He's a very visually clear man. He looks a certain kind of weird.
If you're going to play around with the audience like that and cast the same actors but in different roles in the same trilogy of films, probably not a good idea to cast them as very, very similar but not different characters.
Yeah, he should have just been... Like, it's nice to have a part. Or he could have been in it, but older, like Max. Max is supposed to be quite old. Like, in the first one, he must be in his 20s. I don't know how old Gibson is, but he's a young sort of police guy. And then in the second one, he's older, but seemingly not that much time has passed. But then by this one, a lot of time has to have passed, at least to try and make sense of the plot at the end, which involves kids who formed a weird tribe. But it's just, so, okay, he has to be in his 40s. There's no way he's much older, but it has to be a long time after the second one.
Long enough for him to find a terrible mullet wig.
Yeah, which is weird, because Mel Gibson kind of took to the mullet as his iconic role in Lethal Weapon.
I know.
So he obviously wanted to have a cool long hair thing. I don't know. He looks better with short.
Like, if he's if he's been out in the outback, in the wasteland, for long enough for his hair to get that long, why is it a mullet? Like, has he been styling the top himself and then just letting the sides and the back grow?
Yeah, just ever so occasionally he grabs the hair at the front and chops it off with a knife.
Still shaves his beard, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever. Like, can't worry about it too much. The other thing is, right, with the aesthetic of Mad Max, it has it a lot of the way through 3 that they've established in the previous film and so on. Like, they kind of have less reason for it in the third one. It's more, this is the fashion. Maybe time has moved on, and big shoulder pads that look like the sort of American football, you know, all the utility clothes they had in the gangs and stuff, is now a bit more like, it's just the fashion now. It's less for reason and more for that's how we look, because it's a post-apocalyptic world.
I think the suggestion is, or the idea is, that some, like, pockets of civilization have started to rebuild themselves in some fashion, because you've got, like, the Thunderdome. Like, you have rules and laws and routines, and they've got, like, the wheel, Auntie's wheel, and they, you know, the Thunderdome has a host, and it's got, like, showgirls and stuff, so they're kind of cobbling together a society again.
It's a weird place, because as you mentioned, it's societies will always form. People will always unite in groups, because it's easier to survive in a group with people playing different roles, doing different jobs for each other. So societies, after apocalypses, will get together and form, and they may be rudimentary, they may be even outlaws, but it makes sense that a town has formed around a business, and there's sort of sub-businesses potentially there, like, and then they kind of go, but we're bored. So what we need is a violent sort of game show where we have a dome, people have ludicrous gimmick fights in, like, and also we have rules that involve spinning wheels of punishment. It is very much like, should Anton Deck be in this or something? What's going on? So it's a gimmicky little town with rules has appeared that is ran by... Is it Auntie is the name of the woman who plays... It was played by Tina Turner?
Yeah, and Auntie-entity.
Auntie-entity.
Yep.
What did... Abby, what did you make of Auntie-entity? Legacy, bit weird name.
Tina Turner did all right. But really, she didn't get a whole lot to do.
Just shout rules about.
What are the reasons I got bored during this movie? Is it's 1 hour and 48 minutes long, but I don't feel like anybody actually did anything.
Yeah, there's not any real conflict going on. I mean, Max is dragged up to see. He turns up and he says, "My stuff's been nicked and it's here. I want it back." And he strikes a deal basically where they drag him up to see Auntie, and she has a conflict going on with Master Blaster, who runs the pig fat factory that's underneath the town, that powers the town. And there's a conflict between them, because she considers herself to be the figurehead of Bartertown, and then Master Blaster considers himself to be the one who runs Bartertown, because he's in control of the factory.
Yeah.
And she wants him gone, I guess. So... But it's never made very clear why.
She just...
Like, it just is.
Mm.
He sort of makes her look pathetic by making her admit that she's not in charge when he cuts off the power and makes her, you know, mic'd up to everyone in the town and gets her to say, Master Blaster's in charge. But... It, you know, that's okay, I guess, but they could have developed on it more. But then they don't want to commit to either one of those pair to be a full villain, because they both have redeemable qualities, I guess. But, like...
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of interesting, I suppose, to not have an outright villain. Because, you know, you have got... You know, they've cobbled together this town, and they're both, like... at loggerheads as to who actually runs it, but neither of them are terrible people in the sense that, like, you know, they're not like outright villains like Lord Humongous's gang in the second one, who like tortured people and set them on fire.
Yeah.
But I think that's what makes it so weirdly arbitrary who Max sides with in the end.
It's just all a bit pointless. All the conflict is pointless, really.
Yeah, that's the, I thought there was a decent enough plot. It's not until later when the plot goes out the window that things fall apart.
Yeah, it makes it so disappointing as well.
Yeah.
You're rolling along and you go, oh, this is a bit silly and a bit strange, but it's more or less compelling. And then it gets to that point where you go, oh dear.
I think this film does a lot for, with the setup of Bartertown and the whole thing about the pigs and Master Blaster and what he looks like and the aesthetic of the town and Auntie's, palace place at the top of everything.
It's just a tent, really, though, isn't it? With some fruit available.
But this and a blind Asian saxophone player.
Yeah.
But this is the kind of thing that often, as you can tell from how much I apparently like Super Mario Brothers, it's the kind of thing that endears me to a film when something's imaginatively messy.
Yeah, yeah.
Nah.
They've cared more about just building this weird little world than actually having a plot that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's kind of like they wanted to play with the aesthetics more, so they upped the ante and they cut up some nice concepts, but then they forgot to do the work in writing a compelling story and reason for people to do things.
Yeah.
The simplicity of Mad Max 2 is what's really good about it, is you can play with the aesthetic, but you've got this through line of must get the fill out of the place, you know?
Yeah, that's the problem with the third one, is there isn't really a through line. It's just Max kind of stumbling about and ending up places.
I think the pivotal moment for me was, obviously there's a big second half problem, but as soon as they do the gag where Mad Max turns up to Bartertown to get his stuff back from the guy who nicked it from him, and they do the gag of you have to leave your weapons here, and he pulls out loads and loads of crossbows and guns and weapons. And it's just like, oh, you didn't do any of this comedy in the previous one. Suddenly now, lol.
Well, again, we're back to, edging towards family film territory. Right.
But basically, like you said already, he's called... You have to barter in Bartertown as part of your... You have to have something to exchange to stay there. So So Max is basically, okay, well, I've got me. I can be of use. And basically, that contrives... The big, greasy, fat man with a weird eyepiece decides... you're a bit feisty and you've pulled a gun on me, so maybe we can put you in a fight tournament, which is okay, that's kind of action movie stuff. And then Auntie, who runs the town, is interested, and the test is that if they can stab him in the back when he's not expecting it, he's obviously rubbish, but if he fights back, then, oh, we can put him in the tournament. And luckily Mad Max is like, I'll grab this silver tray and kill you all, haha, or stop you all. Because it's, a bit PG-13.
Yeah.
And they decide, right, okay, you'll be handy for taking down my rival, which, and I think we should talk about this character a little bit, is the character of Master Blaster. He is...
Two people.
Yes. And he has one name, even though he has two names, and they are separate people. It's really weird when they go, yes, he's known by one name, Master and Blaster, and they are separate. But they get referred to as one because, it's a midget on the back of a weirdly masked helmeted man. Yeah. Big dude, stupid, helmet that looks like a sort of old school diving helmet meets knight's helmet meets impossible to see through. What is it? I don't understand. It's just a helmet thing, right? And it has a seat on the back. So, midget guy who is the master can do all the thinking and talking for the big muscly dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, even though he's the brains, he still leaves out words.
Yeah,
that was wrecking me.
Well, the film likes playing around with this idea that people have lost the grasp of English that they had from, I don't know, 30 years ago?
If that.
It's like you guys have grown up and forgotten words because of wars and stuff. But Abby, you were saying that was Recu because he sort of talks with just like a basic idiot or something, even though he's clever.
Yeah, he didn't appear that intelligent. Yeah. They said that he was the brains and he was the one who was harvesting all this methane for fuel. But at no point did you believe that he could.
Yeah, he basically controls a switch And everyone in the factory must do their part to shove the pigs along and shovel poo and make the machines work. It's all a bit whatever. It makes me thin. That'll do. Like, but yeah, he doesn't seem that crucial because he's a bit stupid sounding himself.
Mm.
He's just this old sort of guy in a weird hat sitting on the back of a giant. And he's a threat because he controls the factory to Auntie.
Yeah.
And so, like, also, Blaster of the duo slash one person has a bit of a rep for winning fights and stuff in the Thunderdome, which is a common settle your grievances in court, or in the giant cage with elasticy springs and chainsaws and pointy things that you bounce up and down like babies in. Like... Can anyone understand the rules of the Thunder?
Two men enter, one man leaves.
Oh, you're right. They do chant that a lot. What am I thinking?
Yeah, other than that, there's no rules. Perhaps beyond, you're not allowed to receive anything from the crowd, I think.
No, this is...
Anything that's inside the Thunderdome
is fair game.
And there's lots of sharp, pointy bits and chainsaws and stuff to get stabbed with. Why are they on the babies? Like, the thing you put on babies to go in doorways to keep them busy.
I remember when I watched this for the first time, like, as an adult, I think it was, like, last year sometimes, for the first time since I was a kid, it got to the Thunderdome, and I didn't remember the fight inside the Thunderdome. And it put me initially in mind of, like, you know, a Hell in a Cell or something.
Yeah.
Back in the late 90s when Hell in the Cells were actually bloody and violent and not just two guys fighting in a ring with a cage around them.
Yeah. But, Mick Foley, I don't remember being on a bit of elastic, but you're right.
Yeah, see, that's right. Like, they came in and I thought, you know, I was like, this is going to be brutal. Like, they're just going to smash each other into the side of the cage and grab weapons and stuff. And then, yeah, they strapped them into their harnesses and they started bouncing around. And I was like, what does this add to this fight?
Yeah.
If anything, it's a lot away.
It was just like a game show gimmicky version of like ECW or something. Like, it is just this strange little, let's have a gladiator fight, but let's make it like extreme gymnastic trampolining,
and they,
like, weirdness.
Again, it's a symptom of the attempt for a PG rating, I think. Like, they make out that the Thunderdome is this brutally violent fight, and then it's utterly bloodless.
It's mainly bouncing up and down, hitting each other, throwing people pointlessly so they just bounce in the air and do nothing hurts them.
It's like it's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles level violence.
Yeah, it is odd. I mean, but there is a death though as well, but and that's the big thing at the end. But so basically, Blaster fights Mad Max for ages, and the first thing I thought was, well, if there are no rules, just cut yourself off the stupid elastic things instantly and, like, have a bit of an advantage. And they do get loose and cut themselves free of that and then have a bit more of a scuffle. But it is mainly to have people bounce around with metal things prodding about.
Yeah. But Max has his whistle that he had earlier in the film.
He needs to work in the factory briefly to figure out that noise bothers the big guy.
Yeah, because Blaster is clearly just giant and autistic.
But no one twigged. Suddenly sympathy comes at the end.
Yeah, he uses his whistle that he has, that is established conveniently at the start of the film.
Yeah.
That he keeps in his shoe or something. And then there is actually the introduction of the whistle right at the start of the film when he's lost everything and he picks the whistle up out of his, like, fallen shoe and... There's a really nice shot where he stands against the sunset in the desert and just blows it, and you just hear it echoing over the wasteland. And I thought, I'm in for a treat here.
The other thing that's kind of a passing thing in Mad Max 3 is he has a monkey at the start in his wagon, and the monkey helps him by dropping stuff out the wagon. So it's like his little Aladdin-style Abu sidekick thing. And he comes up a lot. And in 2, he had a dog that helped him. So he obviously gravitates towards animals. But the monkey's barely in it and has many kind of owners briefly. And isn't in it that much. But it's still a weird... So do you... Is the monkey a thing?
Yeah. Is that your monkey? Like, do you know it's there? Like, is it just like barely on the periphery of your vision? I mean, it could be. Like, it could just be a suggestion that he's like vaguely heartless and he's letting this animal tag along, but he doesn't really care.
I think, Abby, didn't you mention like you watching two and you said like, is the dog called Dog or something?
Yeah.
And you kind of liked the fact that he had a dog called Dog.
Yeah, yeah, you did. And we assumed that in this one the monkey was called Monkey.
Yeah. So yeah. Maybe that's just Monkey the Monkey, and he helped Mad Max, but he's independent as well. But anyway, we were talking about the finale of the fight in the Thunderdome.
Yeah, he uses his whistle to freak Blaster out, and then I think he knocks him down with something and
a giant mallet.
Yeah. How does he knocks the helmet off, and
yeah,
then he like rears up with the mallet to smash his head in and looks at him and notices, oh, he's a bit ugly, I'd feel bad. And he's got, yeah,
he has a sort of Down syndrome face or something. He sort of looks a bit mentally like I don't know how to,
it's hard not to say retarded.
It's weird to say, but he basically looks like he has Down syndrome or something, and it's horrible to say that, but it's basically the movie going, yeah, doesn't he look like he has special needs? It's like, we all knew he was dumb anyway, because he had a like guy controlling him, but
I think it's
Clara, yeah, it weirdly visually, like, that's a bit wrong, isn't it?
It's like, the fact that like when Max like drops the mallet, he smiles and stuff, and you're like, oh, he's not so bad, even though he's probably done lots of terrible things and killed lots of people in the Thunderdome.
And for me, it felt like there's a weird moment in the first one. Mad Max has a character who is quite, there's a character that they meet. The Max and his wife and his son are staying with someone, and that person, the old woman, has a son or something that's in the woods, and he's a large dude, and he's clearly got special needs. And I was almost like, wait, is this a reference to that guy? Is this how he lives in society now? But no, I don't think it was, but it was just a sort of, you had a guy like that in the first one, what's going on?
Maybe that it's, you know, sparked some memory in Max or something, that's why he hesitated.
I think he just, you know, generally has sympathy and doesn't want to kill the guy.
Yeah.
And then everyone's like, that defies the one rule, which is two men go in, one man goes out.
Yeah.
EC dub. But basically then someone ends up crossbowing that guy anyway, Blaster.
It's Iron Bar, isn't it? The sidekick with the mask on the, sticking out the top of his head.
Okay, so what is with this dude? Like,
I just found out that the actor's name is Angry Anderson.
I know.
First name Angry, second name Anderson. Go on, Ab. Do you want to describe the guy that in the film?
He's a I don't know where to begin. He's not the tallest men, but he's not tiny. And he appears to have some gumption, but not a lot of skill.
Yeah, he looks like a lesser member of the Undertaker's Ministry of Darkness from the late 90s. Like, he'd be like Midian or someone.
Yeah.
Or Gangrel.
Yeah. He's just got a bit of a tattoo on him, and like he's bald, and he has weirdly a pole with a mask and some hair on a stick, like a sort of vague sort of samurai carrying a flag with them all the time thing, but not, because it's just a weird kabuki mask or something.
Mm.
And he's very resilient, because at one point his car's ran over, he explodes into the front of and is then still alive on the front. And I think he gets he sticks the finger up from the rubble at some point at the end.
It's he has his cartoon explosion moment where he's blown up on the front of the truck train thing.
Yeah.
And then you see him playing it on and he's all black because he got blown up. It's like a Bugs Bunny kind of, or more Daffy Duck kind of moment. Like, his nose is on the back of his head now because he got blown up.
It's just a much more corny kind of violence. Yeah. Strange. And yeah, so he's the guy who finishes off Blaster. And I don't understand. If Auntie had a problem and needed Blaster killed, this is the thing, isn't it? She wants him to die in the Thunderdome so that she can keep Master on side and keep him working for her.
Yeah, it's a political move.
And he won't be as strong.
To humiliate them as
he
well.
And he won't be as strong because he won't have his brawn. But I guess she could have just assassinated Blaster anyway. You know, he's still Like, I don't know. It seems that the Master is very crucial to the methane production in town.
Her plan is very drawn out, and as if she's been plotting this for a while, it was really hinging on a capable guy happening to come along.
Well, they had lots, probably. He's probably had lots of fights where, oh, he wasn't capable enough.
They do say, don't they, two men enter, one man leaves, and with Blaster, 21 men enter, and Blaster leaves. So I guess he's worked his way through a few competitors.
So, after Max... After Blaster's killed, surely Max can leave. The rules are, like, Max is alive, he's dead. Yes, it wasn't him, but someone else just killed him. I mean, that'll do.
Auntie says he broke the law, so now he faces the wheel.
That's right, we need to, you know, have a game show again. And spin the wheel of fate and see what... I liked as well that on the wheel they had lots of these bizarre punishments that I didn't quite read. I didn't know if you guys...
Auntie's choice.
That's nice. That's just a soup of the day.
Yeah.
there was one where you get to play Deal or No Deal. This general knowledge quiz was another one.
To be honest, I would rather go out into the desert in the gulag than have to deal with Noel Edmonds for an extended period of time. So
that's a small mercy. Yeah, so he gets gulag, which I thought was a food. But apparently it's being tied backwards on a horse with a weird papier-mâché funny face put over your head. And then the horse is whipped... and possibly given water as well.
Don't they put the stick with the water dangling off the end in front of the horse so it keeps walking?
All right. Because if it was whipped, it could just come back after it realizes.
Yeah, it would go a few steps and then go, hang on, I'm not going out there.
So they strap a carrot on a stick in front of the horse to make sure. Yeah. Okay. But anyway,
I don't understand why that's gulag, because a gulag is a prison.
Oh right. Well, yeah. It still sounds scrummy, though, doesn't it?
I would have thought that would just be, like, exile.
Yeah. Like in the Batman third one as well. Like, you will die by exile or whatever it is.
Well, that is a gulag. Where?
Oh, right.
He's set, because he goes to the pit, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So they've maybe mixed up. Anyway, he's basically sent into the desert, which is pretty much everywhere, and left to die on the horse. And as soon as the horse dies, he can then set himself free, and he couldn't before. I don't know why he couldn't just fall off the horse or whatever.
Yeah.
Did anyone understand what was the problem with him getting off the horse once he was out of sight, or thought he was? Because he's left.
He didn't know when he was out of sight, I guess.
He didn't know when. Oh, I suppose that'll do. And this, then, after this, is kind of the massive obvious problem, where, okay, we've gone on that silly journey, and now the film is bored and wants to, like, do a whole different thing with...
Welcome to a different film.
Yeah, just different film. It's kind of like Hook, but stupider and more annoying.
Oh,
I quite like Hook as a film. There's a different thing altogether, but
see,
it is very much like The Lost Boys.
Weird to me that you could like Hook and not like Super Mario Brothers or this, because to me they're very similar.
I don't know. I think there's a lot riding on you liking Peter Pan initially as a story. So,
well, I suppose, but I like those, like this one and Super Mario Brothers. Hook is a cacophonous mess of a film.
But this didn't have a Rufio or a Tum Tum or any of them lot. Well, anyway, Abby, do you want to explain what happens when he's found in the desert? Give yourself a chance to start telling the listener a bit more stuff.
He's found by. A teenager, I guess? A teenage girl?
Yeah. Slightly androgynous, but yeah.
And gets taken back to the camp, which is populated entirely by children.
In which makes very little sense.
Yeah, that's what I was going to bring up next. That some of them are teenagers, but surely at some point there must have been enough adults to make those children.
Well, they reference one of them being pregnant very briefly, but like, you don't think about it too much.
And also, like, because they have a little explanation. They find Max and they have him as some kind of, there's a prophecy or something that's been told to them.
They think he's Captain Walker.
Yeah. What's the deal then, right? Their story, which they tell in annoying broken English, I think Abby was saying, Yeah, it's like it's made by just pretentious performing arts students or something. What were you saying at the time?
Pretty much what I said, yeah.
Yeah, just performing artsness goes up 10 notches at this stage.
I couldn't work out quite what the story was. I think what it was that the apocalypse happened, like whatever the war, like war or whatever, and then this one guy, or their story goes that Captain Walker gathered some survivors into a plane and took off, and the plane went down in the desert.
Mm.
And then the survivors found their little like cave network that they live in, their canyon, and like they set themselves up there to live. But was it a plane full of babies and four adults?
That's like, right.
And
yeah, because they talk in a stupid sort of, we must have only learned English to a point, and therefore they say certain words wrong and refer to things as the before time and remember in the before time when stuff was different and in the tomorrow place, and they just talk like babies, but like slightly, they know enough to get by and stuff, and they nearly have their own language, but not really. But they've created a kind of quasi-religion, which is based on essentially some stories they must have been told by adults of how things were before. Like, because these must have been raised there for a while, because they were kids who haven't learned about the outside world. Because it was only, like, 10, 20 years ago, 30 at best. Like, they all might not have lived in that time, but how are they so terrible at understanding the world?
Yeah, I don't... Again, though, this could come back to the... Well, no, it can't... Oh. Like, I was gonna defend it in saying that the idea of Mad Max being a myth and that there's not necessarily any continuity,
yeah,
which would make sense were it not for the fact that Max references the cities and all that stuff and says there was an apocalypse and it's not there anymore, which suggests that he was around when it happened, that he saw it happen.
Yeah, they had like lives before, like I think Auntie had a different, there was nobody is what she puts it as, and now she's somebody after the event, so.
Yeah, so the film basically clarifies that it happened in fairly recent history.
It's not even outside of a different,
it's not
outside
a generation.
Of a lifetime, even, really.
Yeah.
It's like a couple of generations ago, everything was maybe depressed, but normal.
But somehow these kids have become cavemen.
So they were somehow crash-landed there. Maybe there was a couple of adults, the adults died or whatever, and the babies survived in a kind of lost babies.
Like, I also don't understand how... Like, I guess they must be really good hunters, because...
They all have furs and stuff.
Yeah, and they're, like, a couple of them are pretty, like really muscular and fit, and then one of them is really fat. So, like, where did he come from? Like, are they just fattening him up? Do they do that? Do they fatten one up and then eat him?
Let's not worry about the cannibalism that is probably there.
Well, that's the thing. Like, if we're going to approach Beyond the Thunderdome in the same way as the first and second films, this is a group of incestuous children who cannibalize each other.
But either way, they have, like, loincloths and furs, but they also have modern-day technology stapled to, like, sticks. They have, like, a record on a stick, and they have, like, circuit boards as necklaces, and we've got modern stuff, but we don't know how it goes, so we'll put this gun on a stick. Like, and they're just, they're kind of idiots. It's like, why did they not learn properly? It must have been little babies when they learnt, because they haven't grasped adult life at all.
I like this idea that it's not necessarily because of the post-apocalypse or anything like that, it's just that this is a tribe of idiots.
It's just terrible parenting.
They're just really stupid.
Like, you know, kudos for living that long, but come on. And they have a quasi-religion based on fairy tale stories. Not even fairy tales, just one adult going, oh yeah, you might not understand little Ben and Jessica, but we used to live in a big city with tall buildings, and that's the kind of understanding they have. But they've turned it into a religion and a sort of traditional... they have formed this weird, primitive village.
It would make sense if it was set further away from the actual apocalypse and there were some adults.
That's what I think. The whole premise, which I have discovered a reason for in a second, I'll come back to, is ruined by the fact that it was in Max's lifetime. It was beyond his lifetime. If this...
Beyond the Thunderdome?
then it would be fine. There would be enough distance for generations to not understand the technology anymore because it doesn't work. So how would they?
Yeah.
And it's because this film was originally meant... They had a premise for a film about kids living without parents. And they decided, well, who's going to meet these kids? I don't know, maybe Mad Max? Yeah, sure. Is essentially how it went.
That is, like, that is the major problem with this film, is...
It doesn't go with the film franchise.
Well, no, it's not even that, because I have no problem with every film in a franchise being completely different.
And, oh, sure.
And, because even the first and second one are very different from each other. And I like, you know, seeing people experiment with it and
well, I like both the first two. Different ideas, going in a different direction, but both good. The story is good.
But the problem here is it's two films.
Yeah.
It starts out as a Mad Max film, and then you've got this completely unrelated idea of kids growing up after the apocalypse and looking after themselves.
What if an adult came across the Lost Boys and tried to teach them how to be normal?
Yeah, and no, Abby was right. I saw the same bit of trivia as well. Somebody literally went, what if that adult was Mad Max? And they went, yeah, okay.
It would be a terrible idea that they continued to do. But...
And you can... It's so... I think the major problem is it's so obvious that this is two different stories stapled together.
Mm.
So the fact that it then doesn't come to a conclusion...
They don't even think of a good contrivance to get the two worlds colliding. Because the nearest civilization is Bartertown. It doesn't seem that far because Mad Max, even when dehydrated and worn out, can just about make it between the two. Maybe the kids couldn't have gone that far. But it's not that far away. And the people in Bartertown have vehicles and could have easily have found these little villagers or whatever. Anyway, the point is, when Max is told the stupid story in a art student-y kind of pretentious performing arts way, and he goes, oh, look, I'm not this weird captain. I don't know why he looks like me either. But no, guys, and like Max in all the films, I'm just walking away from this one.
Yeah.
It's a tradition. Mad Max goes, no, I'm walking away. No, I'm leaving. This is too much. And then ends up, you know, helping anyway.
But that's the other thing as well. Like, in the previous films and in the second one, he has some reason for changing his mind.
Mm. Mm.
And in this one, he just changes his mind.
Like, some of the kids go off and he has to go and stop them. He punches out a girl as well. But he wants to stop them going off, determined to find this other city that doesn't exist.
He basically says, you all have a pretty good life here. Just deal with, you know, live here, be happy.
Yeah.
And then they go, no, and storm off into the desert. So, yeah, I guess that's his motivation. Like, I got to go and help him. Yeah.
And then there's some unnecessary sinkhole sand pit thing, sinking sand that doesn't really make sense. Swallows up one or two of the kids and he rescues some of them.
How do you even get into the situation where five of you have formed a string of people trying to save the one at the bottom who's getting sucked into some sand?
Well, it starts off as one person grabbing hands, then the next person goes, help me! And then they grab the ankles and they go, oh no, help me! I don't know. It's not even that good a bit. It's just, oh, I feel bad because one of the kids didn't come out. And the numbers dwindle inexplicably throughout. Like, there's a whole, like, tribe of children. Well, and then as it goes on, there's enough to fit in a small helicopter, a small plane, like.
He leaves some of them behind, presumably to continue living in the... Because he leaves, like, the older teenage boy.
This terrible mullet. They all had muddy mullets, didn't they?
Oh, I know. And
they cut Max's hair. I don't know why they decided his hair was not...
Oh, I'm very glad they did, though. Yeah. But, this was where it does, like... Even though it is obviously two different films, each one has the potential to be interesting, but they both stop before they reach that potential. Like the first bit in Bartertown. It just goes, it stops, and they go, all right, get out. And they send him out into the desert. And then he meets these kids. And then that starts to build up. And then it stops, and he goes back to Bartertown. And why?
Yeah.
I think the... Sorry, go on.
No, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. I know, it makes sense that when they're in the desert, if you're closer to Bartertown than the other place, go to Bartertown. But I don't understand why they kicked up a whole load of trouble in Bartertown, when it seems like they just could have snuck in, maybe got a bit of food and water, and sort of hidden that pipe that they used to come in.
Yeah. Sell one of the kids and get water and food to get back to the other place.
I had no idea at that point when they sneak into Bartertown what they were actually doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they nick a giant train thing and what is it?
Right, okay, this is how I understand it. They get in through some kind of sewer system, they sneak in and they see the semi-friend Max made, Pig Killer.
Pig Killer, yeah.
Who's working in the, you know, factory shoveling pig excrement. And they didn't really buddy up. He was just there while Max was seeing what his foal would be like. And now the master is forced to be there and bullied to stay and keep working there. And I don't know, they think maybe if I rescue these guys or something, they can help. And he sort of starts to rescue them and they get in trouble. Basically just because there's a weird half-head shaven kid with like panda eyes, like paint, like it's sort of suntan lotion or something on his head, and some blackened eyes, and he sort of gets them in trouble. They all fight the guards, they beat the guards, throw guys in pig excrement, and then they steal this van thing that's somehow part of the machinery and like maybe it's the engine for the.
To me, it looked like they took all of the underneath of Bartertown with them. And then drove off with it. But it's on a railway. It's a train.
Sort of. It's like a van train thing, isn't it? With a house that the master sometimes lives in. And keeps all his formal clothes when he's not being S&M bondage guy.
Oh.
And that blows up the thing. But and everyone's like, oh no, it's blown up. That makes this town pointless. Let's all leave. Wait a minute, says Tina Turner. We can just bully Master if we get him back and rebuild. And I won't be losing my job as queen of the mucky people.
That pretty much sums up any motivation that anyone had for doing anything from this point on.
Yeah.
And then
there's no one else capable of making some kind of Phil. Or just getting on without Phil, I don't know. Like, mining? Can we go back to mining in a post-apocalypse? I don't know. Farming? But it is hard. I'll give him that. When you've had technology and society and all that, and it crumbles and falls away and you haven't got it, you do want to cling to the metal shanty town rubbish that you've got, but not at the cost of your dignity. Not when you could be wearing your loincloth and living off the land.
But yeah, they charge off into the desert and they get chased. I don't know what the guys chasing them would think they could do if they caught them.
Well, they all need to get into their Mad Max-style vehicles that's a bit Wacky Racers. It's like Wacky Racers. Like, because in the second one, it's like repurposed cop cars. And
yeah.
They've nailed a few things to old cars that still work, and they've probably stolen them from places. But in this, it's like there's a cow print car with cow print, there's weird shapes, and there's like metal cage vehicles and giant engine things. It's all like,
it is obviously like now they had American funding, they had loads more money to play around with.
Yeah, what if the Wacky Racers were a bit more rusty looking? That's kind of the vehicles they have.
It is, you can tell though, like there's another thing that is very different in this one is there's very little action apart from the fight in the Thunderdome and then the siege of Bartertown and the chase. That's it. Like, most of the film is exposition. And the director, George Miller, actually didn't direct the majority of this one. I think one of the producers of the previous two died when he was scouting for locations for this one.
Mm.
And George Miller, like, decided he wasn't going to direct it. So they had George Ogilvy come in to direct like the bulk of the film, and then George Miller came back to do the action scenes, and you can tell, especially in the final chase, because suddenly everything gets quite good. Yeah. Like the chase itself, like in the other two, is well put together, and there's some legitimately dangerous stunts. I don't know if that's a thing George Miller likes to do, like when Iron Bar's hanging off the thing sticking out the side of the train thing, and the like metal rung things are coming at him, and he has to lift his legs up to like avoid being obliterated, basically.
I hope that stuntman got paid like 10 times what he normally would for the gig, because that was insane.
I know. But that's the kind of stuff George Miller obviously likes to do and can do very well.
The directing, I think you'll agree, because me and you watched it quite recently, but Mad Max 2 has some tremendous directing all the time, doesn't it?
Mm.
Again, it's very... it's very kind of lean. And
You sort of build the props and get the costumes right, and you go far away in the nice Australian outback, and you film all of the action happening... And it looks just good because there's lots going on. Yeah. Or there's lots of cool vehicles going fast and dust being kicked up. And it really does work.
And it's, yeah, I can. The third one, just because there's so little action, it just seems like a slog. And when the action does happen at the end, you're like, yeah, now we're talking. And then it stops.
And there's not the same amount of like crashes and things because it's kind of being a bit more PG.
Yeah.
It doesn't. You don't have violent crashes and deaths all the time. In fact, that guy who does all those stunts, his character just stays alive despite being killed several times.
Yeah, very resilient.
Most people, they just sort of drop and fall away. A lot of the cars don't even do much more than chase.
Yeah.
Like, I think Auntie is just on a big engine vehicle following them for a while, being all, look at me, I'm Tina Turner with weird hair and big earrings. Shah! Like, that's about it. And they chase them for a bit. I mean, what happens in that scene other than they chase them and occasionally something like...
Well, they happen to stumble upon Jedediah and his kid again.
Yeah.
And then they kind of, I don't know, they find him and they say, right, come on, get your plane, we're loading these kids on and we're going to fly to a city. And Jedediah's like, what? And Mad Max basically goes, there, I'm telling you, you're doing it.
How did Max know that he was a pilot?
Because he nicked his stuff at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
He knew it was him.
And he actually managed to eyeball him at some point. I see. That was not made clear.
No, I know. He must have spotted him and recognised him or something.
Basically, at the end, the train line comes to an end, and the kid who looks a lot like the kid from 2... who had a boomerang to kill people with, is there in a pick helmet and is trying to rob them, but then he has to run away because all the cars are catching up with the train thing.
Yeah.
And they all follow him into the weird hideout underground.
I think perhaps one of the things that only just occurred to me, it bothers me about this film, is that the world seems very, very small.
Yeah, there's a lot of... everything's very conveniently placed.
Yeah. And they just happen to stumble over this person, and that one.
Yeah.
But, okay, so basically they crowbar in the idea of, oh, now we'll get in the plane and fly away. And, oh, we can't. There's not enough runway, even though it's a massive open desert. You can point yourself in any direction and there's loads. And you'll be fine. And if you drive at the cars will obviously have to drive out the way. So it's fine, what are you on about? And all that's really happened violence-wise is, I don't know, Pig Killer got a hook through the leg, like that someone threw, like,
yeah,
and that's been resolved. And just, there's not that much at stake, and not that many people have, you know.
It's still, I don't understand what's going on. Like, why is Jedediah okay with, like, yeah, all right, get out, everybody get on board. And then, like,
I guess they fly to the city, but not to back to the rest of the kid villages. Or do they pick them up? It's a very small little plane.
And then they have to dump Max, don't they? Because they're overloaded.
Oh, yeah, because he always needs to be left like the Incredible Hulk, just on a dust road.
Well, they don't dump him, exactly. He volunteers to go.
Yeah.
He drives a car to sort of stave off the guys or something who are coming at him in cars.
Mm.
And then they catch him, and they do absolutely nothing with him.
Yeah, all the rusty Death Race 3000 crew turn up and go, oh, well, I guess the master got away, therefore, shrug, let's go.
Oh, Tina Turner says, well, aren't we a pair?
Yeah.
And leaves. A pair of what? Exactly.
A pair of useless characters that haven't got a conclusion and no menace.
Yeah, and then he just collects a bunch of stuff together and walks off. And yeah, the kids and Jedediah fly to Sydney.
Which is all dirty and dusty and abandoned.
Yeah, so there's nothing there. And they sit around and have babies, I guess.
And tell stories and sort of... I don't know if they're, like... Presumably they're not related to each other. We don't really know much about the children's origin, so hopefully it's not like an Adam and Eve thing. It's just two of them, but... It is just a bit wrong, isn't it? And they're all just so stupid. Society's going to be born from just morons. I guess we all were, initially. Like, no offence, our great-great ancestors, but you guys were cool. You had... didn't have loads of technology to misunderstand and history to forget in 20 years. You had nothing.
Our ancestors invented things.
Yeah.
They're anti-inventing things.
They're using inventions wrong.
Yeah. You'd think society would be better off, but I'm kind of hoping these tribes just get... Like, someone else just turns up in Sydney, like another roaming gang of, you know, people who actually remember what it was like to be normal and think, oh, we'll just kill all these stupid teenagers and kids and we live in Sydney instead. You know, it's Sydney's pretty big. I'm a bit surprised they even need to live there. I mean, it doesn't matter, really, does it? It hasn't got anything going for it other than pre-built buildings.
It's built up when they actually get to the city. Like, it's like, oh, we made it. You know, we're here. Wouldn't they have been colossally disappointed with the fact that it's just as much of a wasteland as everywhere else?
And if people have left in droves, surely it must be because it's like the nuclear fallout is...
Yeah, it's incredibly radioactive, especially considering how recent the apocalypse actually was.
Yeah, so whatever. We're left with them telling stupid, annoying stories in that broken English way. And we go, why does Mad Max just left alone at the end again?
Because, you know, like you said, he's like the Incredible Hulk.
And he just needs to go down the road. Da, 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 da.
Yeah, no, but
wish
not
my family wasn't killed and I'd lost my purpose.
But it's not that. It's We Don't Need Another Hero by Tina Turner that he walks off to. Just to make this as 80s as possible.
I think the main thing about Mad Max 3 is... I enjoy the aesthetic. It goes a little like, what is the point now? Because I like the utility of everything in the second one. But other than that, other than the potential, I don't know if I think it's got anything. It's just kind of like, why? Why did you spoil it with all this silliness when you could have just had another great story about a legend of the post-apocalyptic world? Just a guy who fights, but he fights in weird beefed-up cars. That would have done me. But no, we had to have weird kids being helped. And not enough. I didn't miss the violence. It just, because it wasn't there and it was in the other ones, it seemed wrong. You know?
Yeah, it seems like such an obvious PG grab.
Mm. The thing I don't like is that other than the actors who had to learn their lines, I don't feel like anyone read the script at any point.
Yeah. And it felt less Aussie as well, I think. Like, it was very... Like, all the characters are very Australian in the others. And they all look like normal people. And it doesn't feel like actors. And in this one, it just feels like everyone is a little bit of a character. They're Hollywood and a bit strange.
Yeah, again, it's the American financing, isn't it? It became, like, bigger and, in a sense, more ambitious. But that also... It ended up kind of locking it into being a I don't want to say cliche, because these films still hadn't, like...
Yeah. There was only one place left to go, and you shouldn't have gone there.
You smoothed all the edges off, and you faked the rust instead of letting it be real.
Yeah.
So, okay, guys. It's not a hit with us, but I think, Jamie, you were probably the most positive. Do you want to have your final thoughts and maybe give a rating out of whatever we could think of? Just slam some things together in a post-apocalyptic way as a rating system.
I don't know, because in spite of everything, I don't hate it whenever I watch it. Like, it's one of those films where I'm sitting there thinking, what is going on? What? And I can see all the flaws. Again, it's a Super Mario Brothers situation. I just find it adorable. I can't think of a better word. It's endearing, because it's so, like... For this one in particular, it's so 80s. Like, it's the logical conclusion to an 80s post-apocalyptic franchise where there's mullets and shoulder pads, even though the apocalypse has happened. But And I think part of why I like it as well is for all its flaws, it's a different spin on something that's been established. And I think there's some merit in that, in including it in the Mad Max trilogy, because they're all so different from each other. And it's just another, it's an attempt at doing it a different way. The problem comes from the fact that they developed it from a film that had nothing to do with Mad Max.
Yeah.
Instead of coming up with an original story and then putting a different spin on it.
Come up with an interesting set piece, an idea.
The Barter Town and Thunderdome stuff, all perfectly potentially interesting.
Yeah, just like it could have been constantly Max trying to outthink and outfight the challenges that the people of Bartertown put on him, really.
Yeah, but...
And then taking them down because they're too corrupt or too something or other, you know?
There was plenty of potential. And just like the idea of the kids surviving the apocalypse, whatever, there's potential in that idea too. It's just...
Did all those pigs explode? That's tragic. if he freed the pigs as his final, like, hooray, that could have gone on to make Babe make sense all of a sudden. Maybe he felt guilty about killing all the pigs, so he wanted to make a lovely story where a pig live.
I don't think he directed the... Did he direct the first one?
Just Babe Pig in the City.
Yeah, which is the weirder of the...
Babe Pig in the Barter Town.
Oh, he also directed Happy Feet.
Of course he did.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like he has a thing about animals, because they were, like, used to great effect in 2. Like, they cut lots of animals and rabbits and chickens running away, and, like, he does something interesting with animals, but I feel sorry for the number of pigs that would have been exploded.
I think his absence from the majority of Beyond Thunderdome is felt.
Mm.
It needs George Miller's, like, kind of brutal aesthetic.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Got any sort of idea on how we could rate this thing?
Because the Thunderdome reminded me of Gladiators. Latter-day Gladiators, where the events became really strange.
They'd run out of gimmicks, and they had to come up with sillier ones.
If we're going with Gladiator stuff, it's like watching someone fail to run up the Travelator.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, come on, you can make it. Oh, you almost got there. Oh, no, he's down at the bottom again.
in many ways, like...
But at least the Travelator's colourful and it's moving.
To get into obscure sort of, like, game show territory, or rather, sort of British game show stuff, for me it's kind of like, if there's Gladiators, which was quite successful, and there's, like, Crystal Maze, which is, again, quite successful, but challenging and fun... It's kind of Fort Boyard, which is a kind of rubbishy Crystal Maze with worse sort of aesthetics and sort of cheesier, sillier outcomes and pointlessness. Inexplicableness. There's a lot of inexplicableness to Fort Boyard. At the end, they just have to collect gold coins from tigers. And you kind of go, what did the general knowledge in the weird, like, the guy from Doctor Who have to do with that? It's such a weird show. Mm-hmm. And Anthony, if he was here, would agree that Fort Boyard is very weird. And straight. So that's, for me, it's Fort Boyard. It's not quite like the good, successful ones, which in their own way were cheesy and a bit, you know, like, you don't take Mad Max seriously, either of them. You know?
No, they're very much trashy exploitation films, but there's a genuine, like, talent behind them.
Yeah. They went on to influence so much of the genre, really.
Yeah. And they're legitimately entertaining as well.
Yeah. Ab, do you have anything else to say on the matter?
To go back to Gladiators, I remember once, they started off when the finish line was basically a giant piece of paper that you went through. But after that, they changed it to a stack of sort of
foam
soft
bricks.
Cubes. Yeah. And I remember once, someone was so tired that they didn't even make it through the bricks. Yeah.
I think at some point they had paper strips instead of just one sheet as well, just to sort of make it easier for them. And then, yeah, just fumbling through the foam bricks, you're so tired and worn out. You just sort of can't quite finish because of foam.
And you're this rubbish. Puts me in mind of that movie, because they knackered themselves out by getting to the end of this movie that it didn't even finish.
Really? Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't finish. It just stops.
So it's someone stumbling so many times on the Travelator, they barely get over the finish line and don't. They just sort of fall in the bricks. And then someone comes over to interview them for being a disappointment and letting their family down.
And they just chant and say, oh, it's the second path that counts.
No, it's not. It's showing up the wolf and his stupid balding perm and his gloating, blast you, wolf.
But even though it's a mess of a film, I still like all three and I'm looking forward to there being more.
I would look forward to there being more, but in that stupid, deluded, you hope that they'll correct the flaws way.
Well, the new one, the Tom Hardy starring one, Fury Road, is only directed by George Miller. It's not a tag team thing like this one was.
Oh, right. But if it's anything less than a 15, there's no point.
Yeah.
And we've had the whole Grindhouse revival thing since then. This is going to maybe fall into that kind of thing, perhaps. So we'll always see.
I would hope so. Yeah.
Or we won't, even if we don't know it'll definitely get made. But if it does, we might have another one to follow up Mad Max 3.
It's due out next year, year after.
But for now, we have to put it to bed at number 3. And that's a shame, because 1 was interesting and different, and 2 was actually quite well done all the way through. And then 3 is, what we've just talked about. I guess that is it from us on Spoiler Filled. So, do they have a greeting in Mad Max 3? They say, do the kids have a stupid tribal, don't know how to say goodbye, so they say, bye, good.
Mostly, they say, ah.
That's what I was saying at the end.
They just chatter and make irritating sounds, yeah.
And if you chant, that taught me one thing, if you chant something, and everyone chants along with you, you have to go along with it. Whether it's a kid's tribe, or a big metal climbing frame with men on, if they chanted enough, it's tough, that's the rule. Anyway, goodbye.
Bye.